I first heard about Ford Ushijima from Auntie Lucy Gay, a professor at Leeward Community College, Waianae Moku, who has a deep knowledge of Waianae history. She told me how, a number of years ago, she first saw Ford playing steel guitar, and when she went to talk to him, he said he'd learned to play from a cowboy in Makua. She was eager to document the history of Makua, and it turned out he was just the right person to ask. He'd compiled a book of his family's history in Makua and assembled a thick file of photos, hand-drawn maps, newspaper clippings, and other documents. He passed all of this on to Auntie Lucy, entrusting her with these valuable materials so they could be preserved for future reference. I met Auntie Lucy the summer of 2021, and she told me I should interview Ford if I could. She hadn't been in touch with him for over a decade and didn't know if he was still alive, so we went in search of him. The contact information he had given her all those years before was out of date. We tried the alumni services of the Mid-Pacific Institute, which we knew he attended, but they didn't have any contact information. I called Luna Lilo Homes, a retirement home where he used to go play music for the residents, but they never got back to me. Eventually, we decided to try an address Auntie Lucy found on one of his envelopes in the file. We drove over one morning, knocked on the door, but there wasn't an answer. No one at home. So we tried the neighbors across the street to see if they knew. The man who answered the door said he remembered the Ushijimas, but they had moved a while ago. He didn't know where to, but he did have an old phone number. While we stood at the door, he called, and someone picked up. It was Ford's son. He handed the phone to Auntie Lucy, who explained who we were and our interest in Makua. She asked him, "Is Ford still alive?" I held my breath until I heard her give a sigh of relief and say, "I'm so glad to hear that." Ford was now living with his daughter Luana. He was almost 97, and his short-term memory wasn't great. But when it came to his childhood in Makua, she said, it was all still there. We arranged a time to meet with him, to hear the last living memory of life in Makua Valley before the war. I'm Kenji Cataldo, and you're listening to Before Us, a new audio documentary podcast about U.S. empire and grassroots movements for peace and liberation. In this season, Makua Piko of Peace, we're diving into the history of Makua Valley on the island of Oahu in Hawaii, which was seized by the U.S. Army during World War II and used for bombing practice for 60 years. In the last two episodes, we learned about the communities that lived at Makua Beach until the final eviction in 1996. We heard from Uncle Sparky Rodriguez and Uncle Vince Dodge how organizers from the village community at Makua Beach and activists from the peace and justice movement joined forces to form Malama Makua, an organization leading the movement for the return of Makua Valley. We joined a cultural axis in Makua, learned how Malama Makua got past the fence through a legal battle, and were invited to imagine what Makua was like 1,000 years ago as a thriving Hawaiian community. If you didn't catch the first two episodes, I'd recommend pausing now and listening to those first. By the 20th century, the community and landscape in Makua had changed significantly. Makua was home to a multi-ethnic community of ranchers, rail workers, farmers, and fishers. But even with the introduction of private property in the mid-1800s, and the new social and legal arrangements brought on by land deeds and leases, even after the arrival of American settlers, and after the onset of American occupation and rule at the turn of the century, the community in Makua was a community still deeply connected with the Aina. And while we can only imagine what life in Makua was like 1,000 years ago, today, in this episode, the ranch and the railroad, we're getting snapshots of life in the valley before the war. Part 1, The Ranch.
Tracy, are you able to see if that amplifier works?
I think so.
When we met Ford at his daughter Luana's house one afternoon, he was just getting up from a nap. He had been out that morning playing music with friends, but he was happy to pull out his steel guitar again when we arrived. As we began to speak, he plucked the strings, filling the room with smooth, resonant tones. That's Auntie Lucy speaking.
Not too many people play Hawaiian steel guitar.
No.
I guess you have people who play Western, you know, Western music.
Yeah, cowboy thing.
Yeah, or Southern anyway. Yeah.
Yeah. So we're going to talk about your home in Makua.
Oh, if you want to know about Makua, I got them all.
Little man.
Including the picture. The ranch was a big thing, see, in Makua. There was a ranch and then railroad.
Yeah.
Railroad, you had the railroad go on Kainai, go all the way to Kahuku, see.
Ford grew up in the Makua of the 1920s and 30s. The valley was home to a rural community structured by the ranch as well as the railway that passed through. At that time, a train ran from Kahuku at the far end of the North Shore, around Ka'ena Point to Makua, and down the leeward coast to Honolulu, carrying sugar and pineapples from plantations to the port. The ranch and the railway had brought a diverse community to Makua. Aside from the rail workers, who were all Japanese, there were Hawaiians on Kuleana lands their families had lived on for generations, and Hawaiian and Portuguese cowboys who worked for the ranch, which was owned by a wealthy American landowner.
Actually, it was a ranching community, you know. This guy, McCandless, he used to be the landowner of Makua. And he used to raise cattle, see, you know. So ranching was a big part of that. And he also raised pigs. And the way he raised pigs was he let the pigs run all over the valley, you know. And then about 5 o'clock, they would ring a bell, you know. And pigs are smart, see. They would hear the bell and they would come running.
Work opportunities in the ranching community were primarily for men. Ford talked about John Enos, who was foreman at Makua Ranch, and the experiences of his children, Hattie and Willie.
Yeah, John Enos, Makua Ranch, I think he was, the foreman or something like that, yeah. And I used to go there all the time. And he had 3 or 4 kids. Was John, Willie Enos. There was Hattie Enos, and I think there was Clifford Enos, you know. And Hattie married somebody up in Pu'ea, Haliva, Lulu'ale side, you know. But Hattie, later on, I didn't realize it at that time, but she was a very smart girl, you know, yeah. It's just that she never had a chance to make that much use of it, you know. Those days, if you were born in a certain circle, that's where you stayed. You have no access to climb up the economic level of it, you know, yeah. But I noticed that she was very akamai about anything, you know. So, that's what I remember about her. And really, he was a cowboy. Forever a cowboy, you know. But they were nice people, all nice people, yeah.
The Ushijimas joined the community in the valley in 1907 when Ford's father, Kiyosaku, migrated from Japan aboard the Koreamaru and came to Makua to work for the Oahu Railway and Land Company, where his brother-in-law was a foreman. 5 years later, Ford's mother, Yei Kimura, came over as a picture bride, arriving in the spring of 1912 and marrying Kiyosaku 2 days later. They lived in town for a few years, where Kiyosaku worked as a stevedore, and they had their first 4 children there. But after a number of years, they moved to Makuo again, where Kiyosaku returned to work for the railway. Yei and Kiyosaku had 4 more children in Makuo, including Tetsudo, who would get the nickname Ford. The Ushijimas lived in several residences in Makuo, ending up at the foreman's cottage at the railway section camp. They would get water from wells, which were numerous in the valley. Ford remembers 2 wells at the second residence, one for drinking and one for watering their papayas. The house also had 2 mango trees nearby, which would often confuse other people. One was an Indian mango that turned red before it was ripe, while the other was a Chinese mango that stayed green even after it was ready to eat. At the 3rd residence, the foreman's cottage, they had a furo, a separate bathhouse like they might have had in Japan. Ford would gather the branches of kiawe trees to heat the bathwater. They didn't have electricity and relied on kerosene lamps at night. Ford enjoyed his childhood, but life in the valley was hard work. Alongside Kiyosaku's work at the rail camp, the Ushijimas farmed, growing most of their food and selling produce for additional income.
We were self-sustaining in a way, you know. We raised our own chicken, and then fish, it's right over there, you know. We either go nighttime or during the day. During the day, I used to go fishing from one end to the other, you know, and walk along the beach and with the pole in the water, you know. So our diet was mostly the fish, you know, because it was all free. I mean, you know, the only thing you bought was shoyu and rice. Eh? That's the main thing. Yeah, and sugar, you know, and salt. You get, because by the cave, by the cave, below the cave, there was a traditional Hawaiian salt sauce, you know, because there was a reef and the ocean over there, and then a mile off that towards the shore, there were little, not pot, but anyway, the water would accumulate. Yeah,
like potholes.
The potholes, And it would dry out. Yeah. And what was left was salt. You know? So it was a great salt sauce for the Hawaiians from way back, you know.
According to Auntie Lucy, in the old days, long before Kamehameha I united the islands as a single kingdom, Makuo was famous for its sea salt.
I read in a book about that place with the salt.
Yeah.
And it said before, like in the 800s, the 900 AD, the Hawaiians from the windward side would come over to Makua and would get the salt from that place you described.
No kidding.
Because it was, the Hawaiians saw, looked at it as the best salt. It was very fine.
Oh.
Yeah.
1,000 years after that time, when the Ushijimas were in Makua, the ponds that Hawaiians used to harvest sea salt were still in use. Ford also learned how to fish moi, a prized fish that was once reserved for ali'i.
Further out towards the ocean, there was something like a cave underneath, see. Yeah, it was a moi hole, you know.
Oh,
I used to go catch moi over there, see, you know.
Just outside the salt pond?
No, Makai.
Makai of the pond with the salt.
Yeah, the salt was accumulated in the small little ponds with a reef, rock, rock reef, you know. So with a high tide, the wave used to come up, and then the thing would dry out as the tide receded, you know. But anyway, on the side over there was a cave underneath sea. So there was a lot of moi in there, And then I used to go fishing. If I catch 1 or 2 moi, you know, moi is a good fish, you know. Yeah. But then I learned that nighttime they would go out, see. Oh. So I would palu, get a can of sardine, mix it with the sand, and then as the sun would set, I would throw that hauna, outside the cave, see, yeah. you know. And the moi would go crazy, you know. And they would bite anything, you know. And I used to catch about 2-3, and then, you know, in about 5 minutes, I mean, you know. So, but after that, moi spooks very easily, see. They would spread out like that, you know. So when you throw net, you gotta watch how the moi school go here, go there. And so for each wave, you know what's gonna happen next. And that's where you throw the net, see. So when you throw the net, the moi would spread out, see, and it would run towards the net, you know. So this you learn from the Hawaiians, I mean, you know. So I guarantee I didn't. The school usually maybe get about 40 or 50 moi now. Yeah, when you throw the net, you can get about 5-6 at least, you know. But see, when the bottom get all rocks and stuff like that, depend on the formation. If it's kind of flat, then you can catch more. But if you get it's kind of deep, they will run under the net. Yeah. So you got to get kind of heavy lead. So when you drop the net, the thing goes right down. And then no more chance to go out, see, you know. But if you catch boy, 4 or 5 is a good haul.
The Japanese in Makua learned all of this from Hawaiians, many of whom lived off the ocean without needing to work for either the ranch or the railway. While the Ushijimas brought certain customs with them, like the Japanese bathhouse and their taste for shoyu, Ford absorbed a lot as a child in Makua. According to him,
all the Japanese came a little bit Hawaiian. You know, they followed the Hawaiian diet and whatever. The only thing I wonder is, how did the Hawaiians make a living, you know? And the only way was to work as a cowboy or just stay home and living on the ocean, go fishing or get limu. Because, you know, you go on the side of the rock, you know, and then you can catch lobster nighttime or nighttime kind of fish, you know.
Anybody had boat or canoe?
Yeah, had one Hawaiian old man, Pulu Ole, you know. He came from somewhere from Hawaii or Kona or someplace, you know. And he was the one, when he spotted the... What that
the one jellyfish?
Yeah.
Akule.
Yeah, Akule. Yeah. He would call everybody in the valley come down. Because when they caught that Akule, I mean, you could take a whole basket home and still be plenty left. Yeah. And so what he used to do was dig, aside from the shoreline, near Mauka, dig a big hole, you know, and then the fish in a bucket, put a covered with hole. And that was refrigeration. Oh. Yeah, the fish didn't spoil, you know. Mm. The next day when the train come going home to Honolulu, then they would dig it out, wash it all, and then put it in bags, and then ship it to Honolulu and Waianae, yeah, for sale. Oh. Yeah, that was the ice
box. In the sand.
Yeah, bury in the sand. And then it would be as fresh as the day you caught it.
Smart, yeah?
Yeah, they were, you see, in the old days, there were a lot of things that was done which people didn't know or realize unless, you know, you had a chance to go through this kind of experience. I mean, you know, so the people over there adjusted to whatever was needed from all Hawaiian custom, because the Hawaiians did a lot of things that, you know, people don't realize to make things happen. Yeah. So that was it.
Ford grew up living off the Aina and learned much about the abundant ocean resources from Hawaiian friends and community members. He was influenced by the cowboys at the ranch, too. In fact, it was a Paniolo, a Hawaiian cowboy, who inspired Ford to take up the steel guitar.
About the cowboy who taught you how to do this. What was his name?
Kapi'i. I think his name was Kapi'i, you know. And he got a foul with a law or something. So he kind of ran away to Makua. And then you work as a cowboy, you know. And somehow, I used to go over there, and he used to play this ukulele, you know. And sometimes he would play with his knife, you know, the pocket knife.
Yeah.
He would play some songs. I said, hey, that sounds good, you know. So anyway, I saw an ad somehow, I don't remember, but it said that if you sold so many seed, I think of flowers or something like that, you can get this guitar, you know, or steel guitar or something anyway. So I asked my mother if she could buy the seeds. So she bought the seeds, and I mailed her the coupon or whatever, and they sent me this steel guitar. But it was small, just like a ukulele, uh-huh. you know.
Yeah.
But somehow, the guy Jimmy, he started to play the thing. And I got entranced by the sound of the music, you know. And that's how I started to play the... So that was the background for my playing the guitar.
The gift of a phonograph to the Ushijimas introduced Ford to his other musical influence, the hugely popular steel guitarist Dick McIntyre. Amid cowboys and fishers, Ford had a rich and enjoyable childhood in the ranching community of Makua. Despite impacts from the ranch and McCandless's wandering pigs, living off the aina was still possible in Makua. Part 2, The Railway. Before the construction of the railway, Makua was only accessible by boat or by a footpath over the mountains from Waialua. The mountains surrounding the valley extended all the way down to the coastline. In fact, the Ohana living in isolated Makua were more closely related to folks in Kauai Hapai in Waialua than with the rest of Waianae. During construction of the rail, whose primary purpose was to transport sugar and pineapple from plantations to the port of Honolulu, the builders blasted the coastline with dynamite to allow the train to pass through. The railway is what brought the Ushijimas to Makua. The Oahu Railway and Land Company, ORL, employed crews of workers, mostly Japanese immigrants, to maintain the 71 miles of tracks stretching from Kahuku to Honolulu. Ford's father worked for Section Gang No. 6, responsible for the Makua section of the tracks. Part of their work was patrolling the railway, making sure the tracks were clear when the train was scheduled to come through. The workers would use a one-person handcar, the kind where you pump a lever to propel the car down the tracks. It was a long day maintaining the rail line, starting at 6 a.m. and ending at 4 p.m. And outside of that, the Ushijimas were farmers as well.
After work, you're working on a railroad track from 4 o'clock. We used to go out in the fields, a couple of acres, and plant produce, you know, cucumbers, pumpkin, corn, you know.
After some years, Ford's father became the foreman, a position that included a new place to live and a bump in wages from $1 a day to $2 a day. Over time, he would save enough money to purchase a lot in Kapahulu and build a family residence, which would become the gathering place for the extended family in town. The railway also offered certain opportunities its builders hadn't expected.
You know, the pineapple season.
Yeah.
They used to harvest the pineapple in Waiawa.
Yeah.
And then take it by truck down to Kahuku. Yeah, and put it on railroad cars. And then... run the railroad cars up to Honolulu, you know. And they used to pass Makua, you know. So when you come to Makua and come towards the cave, there's a hill, see? So the freight train slows down, yeah. So not me, but the guys used to jump on a train.
Not you, huh?
Yeah, and throw all the pineapple on the sand, you know. Yeah. So we got pineapple, you know. And once in a while, you see, both sides of the track, there's fence, you know, yeah. And sometimes, you know, right around both sides of the track, get planted grass,
yeah.
Because no more anybody to eat the grass.
Yeah.
The cows are used to, from the outside, stick their neck in between the wire fence, yeah. and then and suddenly it fall down inside the track area. See? Yeah. And then one by the train come nighttime with a pineapple, you know. And then the one killed the cattle. Yeah. You know. So when they did that, they would call all the people in Bakua to come and clean up the cattle. And so all the people would come and they cut up all, so we would have plenty of meat, yeah, for pipikaula and all of that, you know, yeah. So that was cause for celebration rather than frustration, you know.
The train also served as transportation for the children of Makua to go to school down the coast in Waianae Town.
At the beginning, they used to have the train come from Kahuku, go town. So all the Makua kids used to go to school in Waianae on the train. Then they would change the thing around so that the train would come from Honolulu, go Kahuku. Yeah, so that screwed up the schedule for the school kids. So my father then had to find somebody with a truck to take the kids to school to Waianae, you know. And then when that happened, now from railroad to the truck, the big rain, the river would fall for so you can go to school. The truck can go, see? Yeah.
Rain, that's, rain, yeah. They call it snow days, I guess that's yeah. Rain day.
Yeah, that was Bakua.
Yeah.
Ford's father had high hopes for his children, sending them to public school until 3 in the afternoon and then to Japanese school afterwards. That had something to do with his nickname, too. Auntie Lucy asked him,
how did you get the nickname Ford?
Yeah, tell them how you
got that nickname.
My father had this notion that I should, he hoped that I would become a famous person like Henry Ford, which was a very high expectation. So that's why. But I think he didn't care, but he just wanted me to reach for the skies if possible.
What would you like people to know most about Makua?
Oh, from nothing there's something. I mean, it looks like nothing over there, right?
Yeah.
But there's a lot over there, you know. It's what you make of it. And if nothing else, you got the ocean over there with a lot of fish and limu and, you know. So it depends on how you look at things, I mean, you know. Yeah.
The community in Makua that Ford described for us came to an abrupt end after the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor in December 1941. All residents in the valley, the fishers, farmers, cowboys, rail workers, and the ranch owners, were evicted so that the U.S. military could use the valley for target practice. At the time of the eviction, Ford was in Honolulu as a boarding student at the Mid-Pacific Institute, but he shared his family's experience with us.
They had to move from Makua because the war started, okay? Now, the Navy had their ships shoot into the valley for target practice. They put big white flag, and then the ship would go by the valley and shoot at the target for target practice, you know? But we were out of there already because we had to evacuate. Mm-hmm. And we evacuated some to Hikilolo, which was by the cave, yeah. This side of the cave. But we moved to Waianae, see. There was a railroad camp over there. Mm-hmm. And so we lived in what they call Kawamoko House. Huts, yeah. Huts made of steel.
Oh, like Quonset hut.
Yeah, Quonset hut. Yeah. Okay. We saw Kamaboko House.
Yeah, Kamaboko House.
Like the
fish cake.
Huh? Yeah.
Like the fish
cake. Yeah. The shape is the same. Yeah. But they were adequate, you know?
They were actually cool, nice and cool.
Oh, yeah.
How did your family, how were they notified that they had to leave? Did the army people come down and just tell everybody?
Yeah,
Mm. How long, do you know how much notice they had? Like, was it like you have to be out today, or did they have some time?
I really don't know, but okay. I would imagine that they gave us adequate time to do that, you know, mm-hmm. because they had to build or provide us housing in Waianae. And that was where the concert hut came in, you know,
So when they came,
The army
came to your door, talked to your father and your mother, and then told you guys
that we had to move out
because
they were going to use the valley for target practice, because it's not all the time. Well, more for safety reasons, right? Because you never know when they might go haywire. You know.
How did the McCandless react? They had to get out too, yeah.
In the ranch, yeah. I think actually the army the president's executive order took charge of everything, you know. So as a landowner, you had no choice. Yeah. You had to abide by the orders from the U.S. Army, So.
But to leave Makua, how did that feel, having to leave the place where you, that's the only place you knew?
Well, you know, nostalgia is fine, but, in a way you think about it, but you know that the situation calls for certain things that maybe you had no control over, you know. So you have, I think you develop a sense of acceptance, you know. And so Japanese called shogunai, no can help, you know.
Shogunai.
Yeah. You go ahead and do it, because what else can you do, you know? You accept whatever they tell you, you know? And so it ended up okay, because we were young enough and adaptable enough, you know, yeah. This was composed by Mrs. Aloha. Pili La'au from Waianae.
Yeah, Aloha Ia'o Waianae.
Yeah, yeah.
What then do the stories shared by Ford Ushijima teach us? The Japanese residents of Makua were the newest in the valley. At the time of the eviction, they were only renters, and they lacked any legal ground to claim damages, like the ranch owners or the Hawaiians on Kuleana lands tried to do. They lacked the deep, century-old ties to Makua and the genealogical relationship to this aina of the Hawaiians. And yet Ford Ushijima, the son of Japanese rail workers, who bears the name of a famous American industrialist, grew up with an intimate knowledge of the fish and the soil and the salt ponds of Makua. He was born in Makua, raised in Makua, raised by Makua, and all these years later he carries Makua with him. What I hear in the stories shared by Ford is the echoes of a lifestyle, of a community, that the Army has prevented three full generations from experiencing through their bombardment of the valley. Ford himself is philosophical about the eviction during the war. But what does it mean that the last living memory of the community is a man who is now 98? That for his children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren, Makua Valley is just a story. For Hawaiians, access to the valley is essential for Pono cultural practice and stewardship of the aina. Uncle Sparky and Auntie Lynette shared last time how the denial of that access is an act of violence. But the impact of the violence to the land perpetrated by the army, the pollution of the soil and water, and the denial of access to the valley extends to all who lived on this aina, all who planted these soils and fished these waters. Do you remember that moihole that Ford described? In an interview with an unnamed fisher conducted by Marion Kelly in the 1970s, the transcript reads,
"At Makua, we get a place called Po'ohuna. That was the moihole. The army spoiled it by bombing. That was the home of the moi. They come out and they go, and when they come home, they go right inside. We had holes. We used to go fish through the holes. Sometimes the moi is so big, no can come through the hole. So you lose them. Then they dynamite inside there.
Next time on Before Us, the story of the lease and how the army stayed in Makua after World War II. Before Us is a podcast produced by me, Kenji Cataldo. This series, Makua Piko of Peace, is produced in collaboration with Malama Makua. A big thank you today to Ford Ushijima for sharing his story, to his daughter Luana Wakabayashi for helping set up the interview, and to Auntie Lucy Gay, without whom none of this would have been possible. Mahalo Nui Sean Chu for voice acting the interview transcript of The Fisher. The theme music was created by No Drama. Additional music you heard today includes Hale Iva, performed by Dick McIntyre's Harmony Hawaiians, and various songs played by Ford himself. Thank you for listening. Ahui ho!